That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 army reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight with me, Behrouz Najafi. Now, let's see who's joining us in this edition. Full professor of political science and deputy dean of research with the University of Western Cape, author of The Politics and Higher Education in East Africa from the 1920s to 1970s, Becky Ngo-Mazulo in Cape Town. Okay, we'll also have the endowed chair of the History and African American Studies, author of The White Supremacy Confronted, Gerald Horn in Houston. Now, Becky, a call-up on this scale has never happened since the end of the apartheid regime in 1994. What's been behind such an unprecedented mayhem and violence in South Africa?
Thank you very much, and good evening to our listeners. Basically, it's a combination of factors. Some of the issues have been there since 1994. When we got our freedom or our democracy in 1994, there were certain things that were not done, and there are a number of promises that were made, but which were never fulfilled. And these things have been piling up. All they needed was just a spark to ignite and then bring the country to where it is right now. So the reason why we have so many soldiers being dispatched to try and contain the situation is because of a number of mistakes that have happened, starting with the manner in which the case of former President Zuma was handled, and then, of course, starting with the Zondo Commission on the allegations of state capture. So there have been a number of mistakes from all ends, and then when those mistakes were not corrected on time, the situation deteriorated and got out of hand. And government was unable to contain the situation using the police, as is usually the case. Hence then the reason to bring in the army to try and assist the police force. This is basically unprecedented in the post-apartheid era, and it's a shame to the country, and shame to the continent.
Okay, Gerald, businesses in South Africa are mainly owned by whites, as you know, and they make up about 9% of the working population there. Now, most of the country's arable land remains are also owned by white farmers. The apartheid is gone, but South Africa still has one of the highest inequality rates. What's your take on that?
Well, I think if you look at what happened in neighboring Zimbabwe, when there was an attempt to redress economic inequality that's grounded in racism, you saw that seizing the land of the so-called white minority caused sanctions to be imposed upon the Zimbabwean regime, and to an extent, those sanctions are still there. That was the signal to the incoming African National Congress government in 1994 that it should tread carefully. Therefore, the finger of accusation should be pointed at the sanctions imposing government, speaking of London and Washington in the first place. And that brings me to the other issue. When the African National Congress government came to power in 1994, one of its major allies, speaking of the Soviet Union, had just collapsed. That helped to empower the major ally of the white minority, speaking of the United States of America, and that also handicapped the ability of the incoming ANC government to address these questions of equality and inequality. And I would add another factor, and that is the maladministration of Jacob Zuma now sitting in prison. In retrospect, it was probably a mistake when the African National Congress government recalled his predecessor, speaking of Thabo Mbeki, who was the successor as president of Nelson Mandela. They recalled Mbeki put Zuma in that position. There were many reasons for that, but in any case, in retrospect, that was a major blunder, because now Zuma and his comrades and cronies charged with looting the treasury of billions and billions of dollars that could have been used to redress inequality, could have been used to to confront this COVID crisis that is now harming South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, Mr. Zuma personally bears a good deal of responsibility for this crisis, as does the members of the African National Congress who helped to put him in office in the first place.
Okay. Now, Becky, as you know, the unemployment rate is pretty high in South Africa, especially among the youth. It's reached a record level of nearly 33% in the first quarter of 2021. So tell us how seriously this unemployment thing could affect the tide of dissatisfaction and all this objection.
Yes, indeed, it is a critical factor. And in fact, what started off as a group of people who were supporting the former President Zuma, as I said earlier on, it triggered the problems that were already underlying there, and we're just waiting for a trigger to spike all of these things that have happened. If you look at the population of South Africa and the population of the African continent, for that matter, it is predominantly young. So then if you have a number of graduates who leave universities and colleges and then join the public with the hope of bettering their lives, and only to find themselves adding numbers to the unemployment rate, then of course it's a cause for concern.
Okay, looks like we've had some technical problems. Let's turn to Houston. Gerald, protests into the jailing of Zuma turned into looting and vandalism, as you know. Is this the disgruntled people? Who is leading this?
Well, that is a major question. The government has suggested that there are disgruntled elements within the ranks of the African National Congress, within the ranks of the security forces, who have played a very negative role with regard to the plundering and looting that has taken place in South Africa in recent days. That bespeaks, I'm afraid to say, the factionalism within the highest ranks of the African National Congress. But there is another issue, too, that should be addressed. Given that we are putting so much weight on the misrule, alleged misdeeds of the African National Congress, that raises the question of where's the opposition? And that, too, is a problem, because if you look at the major opposition party, which is the Democratic Alliance, so-called, it's basically a neo-apartheid policy. It basically seeks to defend the interests of the so-called white minority, and therefore does not have much purchase or much of a reputation amongst the African majority. Then you have a group like the so-called economic fighters, which tries to posture itself to the left of the African National Congress. But recall that when Mr. Zuma came into power more than a decade ago, one of the major backers of Mr. Zuma was Julius Malema, who then went on to lead the economic freedom fighters. In fact, he was quoted at the time as saying he would give his life on behalf of Jacob Zuma. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the political opposition has not carried the kind of responsibility that it should have, and that only contributes to the crisis.
Okay, Becky in Cape Town seems to be back. Becky, you hear me, right?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, Becky, you know, this military deployment is huge and it's extremely costly and could impose further burden on South African faltering economy. And vigilante groups have been formed to protect infrastructure in their neighborhoods. So what's the right way to restore calm?
You know, there are a couple of issues. For me, one of the options is for the justice system to correct itself. Because if you look at the manner in which the case of former President Zuma was handled, as I said earlier on, it was not handled properly. The judiciary was supposed to have looked at what the law says, but then at the same time consider the possible options in law and then look at the political situation in the country. One of the options they would have taken, for example, would be to say former President Zuma has been found to be in contempt of court, and then he's in the wrong, and therefore we find him guilty. But then in terms of sanctioning, they should have just said they are giving him a suspended sentence, not because he has not done anything wrong, but but because they are trying to remedy the situation. The second option was, in fact, in my view, okay. a mistake. And on Monday, by the way, there were presentations by former President Zuma's team trying to plead with the Constitutional Court to reverse its decision, and the judgment has been withheld until further notice. So right now, there is no political solution to this issue, because legally, the president cannot give him pardon unless he has served at least a quarter of his sentence. So the onus now is on the judiciary to rescue the situation without contravening the constitution and also without breaking the law, because in any case, they will be found to have been in contempt of the law themselves. So for me, that is where I see things going right now.
Okay, now let me turn to Houston and ask Gerald what he thinks is the right way to handle this. Because, you know, Gerald, this has been really unprecedented since a long time ago, like we spoke about. You know, there's vandalism, there is looting and killing. So is this army deployment the right thing to do? Could that restore tranquility or what?
I'm not sure if putting more soldiers on the streets will restore tranquility. Recall that just a few days ago, the president, Mr. Ramaphosa, suggested that there would only be 2,500 soldiers. Mm-hmm. Now there are about 10 times that many. And the unrest continues in KwaZulu-Natal. I think that part of the problem in South Africa, and it's a question that has occurred to me and many friends here in the United States, is that it's rather curious that Mr. Zuma, a post-1994 president, has been jailed. And yet these pre-1994 leaders, of which there are many in South Africa, that is to say those who devised apartheid, those who presided over terror and murder, none of them have been jailed. So I would hope that coming out of this crisis is a decision to go after some of the folks who helped to create this crisis in the first place, speaking of these allies of the United States of America, speaking of these enforcers of apartheid, because we all recognize that one of the reasons why there's so much poverty and inequality in South Africa in the first instance that has driven people into the streets is that it's direct legacy of apartheid. If that is the case, and it certainly is the case, will those who helped to devise apartheid and enforce apartheid have blood on their hands and they should be punished accordingly?
Okay. Now, Becky, there are some analysts who attribute the situation to factional rivalries inside the ruling African National Congress Party, and that was what Gerald also referred to. Is that the case in your opinion?
No, it is absolutely one of the contributing factors, but not the only factor. Because right now, if you look at the governing party, you look at the NWC, the National Working Committee, it is divided to the core. You look at the National Executive Committee, it is divided to the core. You look at the PEC, the Provincial Executive Committees, in all the 9 provinces, they are divided to the core. And then it goes down to the local branches. So if you have that kind of a situation, it means that whatever action you take will be interpreted along those lines. And in fact, I may add that when the president addressed the nation both on Sunday and on Monday, he didn't help the situation because he gave the impression that this can be reduced to nothing but ethnic mobilization. That is the concept he used, ethnic mobilization. And I'm one of the people who have subsequently written pieces challenging him on that, saying that if you reduce this important issue to ethnic mobilization, the next thing that will happen, you will have racial problems like we're seeing already right now. So I think there are a couple of problems that need to be attended to, but factionalism in the ANC, in fact, creates fertile ground for all these other problems to crop up.
Okay. Now, Gerald, there are also some people that are saying that there is evidence that followers of former President Zuma have provoked some of the recent unrest to undermine rivals to return him to power. Is that a possibility?
Well, certainly if you look at the social media feeds of some of Mr. Zuma's family members, not to mention some of his comrades and friends, it would obviously lead you to that conclusion. But I think we need to take a step back and look at the region as a whole. That is to say, it was only a few days ago that neighboring Swaziland, Eswatini as it's now called, was going up in flames. People were being killed by the security forces because of protests against the last absolute monarchy on the African continent. Zimbabwe, the neighbor to the north, as mentioned, is still reeling from sanctions imposed by the United States, Great Britain, and its allies because of its land reform program. And that has led to a steady drift, a steady migration of people from Zimbabwe into South Africa, which then puts pressure on the social welfare system in South Africa, puts pressure on the system of employment in South Africa as well, contributing to these problems. And then to the east and to the north, you see problems in Mozambique, which is suffering from an insurgency spearheaded by religious zealots who supposedly have ties to the so-called Islamic State. And in fact, there has been talk about South Africa and its neighbors contributing troops to Mozambique, and that too has led to a migration of Mozambicans into South Africa. So you cannot look at South Africa in a vacuum. You have to look at it in the regional context, and when you do, you see that there are many regional problems that are impinging upon the rule of the African National Congress in Pretoria.
Okay. Now, Becky, business confidence has plunged further, especially with this recent looting taking place in South Africa. On top of that, there is unemployment that you mentioned, especially among the youth, complicating the situation. So what's the solution?
At the moment, there is no immediate solution. The first thing that we can do, I was saying to you, some people in the media houses earlier today, that the first step for me is to eliminate one problem, which sparked this whole thing. That is the issue of the former president. Try to address it within the parameters of the law. Like I was saying, that the judges have withheld the judgment on the appeal that has been made. So that is for me the first step. Because once you eliminate that one, then it means that those who have joined the bandwagon, either as opportunists or as criminals, we will then be in a position to face them, because you will have eliminated the main causal factor. So that is the first step. Then, of course, the other one will be for the government to try as much as possible to make sense of the situation and then bring together the international community, more especially international businesses and local businesses, and explain to them, give them confidence as to how they are handling the situation. Because the longer this turmoil takes, the more difficult it will be for the country to recover economically, given the fact that even before the pandemic, the country's economy was already not doing well. With or without the former president, the economy was just going down.
Now, Gerald, what's your prediction? What's going to happen next in the coming days? Will we see calm or will we see an escalation? We have 1 minute.
It's difficult to make a prediction, but I have to say I'm quite worried about the trend that's taking place in South Africa. You might have seen the statement put out by former President Thabo Mbeki, where he basically made the allegation that the entire post-1994 democratic process may be in jeopardy because of what's going on. Certainly the ongoing unrest in KwaZulu-Natal does not inspire confidence. However, I think that it's important for the South African authorities to redouble their efforts to redistribute the wealth, and particularly to redistribute the wealth on racial grounds, because that's the only way to address the toxic and poisonous legacy of apartheid.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guest. We had full professor of political science and deputy dean of research with the University of Western Cape, author of Politics and Higher Education in East Africa from 1920s to 1970s, Becky M. Gomezulo in Cape Town, an endowed chair of history and African American studies, author of White Supremacy Confronted, Gerald Horn in Houston with their contribution. I've been your host, Pedro Sanchez-Finel. I'll see you next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ya ayyuhar rusul kulu minat tayyibati wa ma'lu salihan inni bima ta'maluna alim.
Allah said, O messengers, eat from the good foods and work righteousness. Indeed, I, of what you do, am knowing.
Throughout the previous programs that you have been with us, dear listeners, we have talked about three sections of this chapter. In the first section, the Almighty Allah in the Holy Quran described mu'minun. قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ, the Holy Quran says. Successful indeed are the believers, and the different characteristics of these people were discussed. In the second section, the story of Prophet Noah was explained. The Almighty Allah saved Noah and his followers from those obstinate people. In the third section, the story of Prophet Salih and his people Thamud was discussed. And in the end, the story of Moses was discussed, and also the story of Prophet Jesus was referred to in one verse. Now, in the 51st verse, the Holy Quran says, يَا أَيُّهَا الرُّسُلْ كُلُوا مِنَ الطَّيِّبَاتِ وَعْمَلُوا صَالِحًا إِنِّي بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ عَلِيمٌ. O messengers, eat of the good things and act righteously. Verily, I know best what you do. This section of the chapter talks about the fact that the religion of Islam is the religion for all. So at first it says, يَا أَيُّهَا الرُّسُلُ, O messengers, كُلُوا مِنَ الطَّيِّبَاتِ, eat of the good things, وَعْمَلُوا صَالِحًا, and act righteously. What we can infer from this verse is that we should not forget two important principles when we want to eat something: the lawfulness of that thing and purity and wholesomeness. All divine revealed religions give great importance to the kinds of food we eat, because they are the things that bring divine succor in doing good deeds. It is for this very reason that addressing all the messengers, Allah says, يَا أَيُّهَا الرُّسُلُ, O messengers, كُلُوا مِنَ الطَّيِّبَاتِ وَعْمَلُوا صَالِحًا, eat of the good things and act righteously. The difference between the prophets and other human beings is not that they do not have human needs, such as the need for food and water. Rather, they see special modes of nutrition as means towards perfection. Therefore, they eat pure and wholesome food, and this has been their way throughout the history. The average person eats as an aim in itself, pursuing the satisfaction of his animal desires, whether it is good or bad. He is not even concerned about the physical benefits of his diet, not to mention the spiritual effects that the food might have upon him.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, regarding that the kind and quality of food is certainly effective on man's spiritualities, and the fact that different sorts of food consequence different moral manners, the relation between these two sentences are made clear when it says, eat of the good things and act righteously. An Islamic tradition says, Allah does not accept the worship of someone who has eaten a single morsel of something unlawful. In this regard, the Prophet ﷺ has said, seeking the lawful things is the duty of every Muslim man and woman. So as you can see, the Islamic traditions say that eating unlawful food hinders our prayers and supplications to be accepted. There is a famous tradition stated by the Prophet ﷺ, which is the evidence of this claim. A man once told the Prophet that he would like his prayers to be answered. The Prophet replied, "Make your food wholesome and refrain from eating unlawful food." Commenting on this verse, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, the meaning of tayyib is lawfulness. In this context, it is also necessary to note that the part where the verse says, "Inni bima ta'maluna alim," verily I know best what you do, is itself an independent reason for doing good deeds. Because when man realizes and knows that someone is always watching his deeds, nothing remains hidden from him, and who carefully reckons his deeds, he will be careful to act correctly and reform his behavior. So the verse says, "Ya ayyuha ar-rusul, kulu min at-tayyibati wa'malu salihan." O messengers, eat of the good things and act righteously, because eating of the good things definitely is effective on these spiritualities. Inni bima ta'maluna 'alim. Verily I know best what you do. We'll talk about this verse more in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key. Unwind all the secrets, this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why? And that's when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
Israel has advanced a major settler building project known as E1. Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, has relaunched the controversial project for the construction of over 3,412 settler units in the occupied West Bank to connect the largest Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim to the West Jerusalem Al-Quds. The project was first pushed forward by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinians have slammed the move as seriously dangerous.
Now, as Bennett brings it on the table, it is just to show the settlers that he's better than Netanyahu. He's continued the main strategy and the ideology of the settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu has been freezing or a little bit slowed down the working in the E1, but they are now pushing it forward. This is a very dangerous colonial project in the West Bank. This will be totally cut off and divided the West Bank between the north and the south. So it's very sensitive, very strategic.
Israeli authorities have been seeking to expel tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouins to other Palestinian towns since long time ago because the area has been allocated to E1 settlement constructions. This area sits on roughly 15 square kilometers of land northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. For years, the Israeli regime has tried to dismantle the Bedouin communities to make way for its massive E1 settlement project in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The planned Israeli building in E1 would effectively cut the West Bank in half and prevent Palestinian sovereign contiguity between northern and southern West Bank.
The project comes in line with Israel's annexation plan. The new regime in Israel is seeking to disrupt any territorial integrity of a future Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders. To this end, it displaces more Palestinians in violation of all international laws.
Palestinians say that it's very clear that Bennett is even worse than Netanyahu, as he started rapidly to carry out his agenda to expand illegal settlements in the occupied territories even more vigorously. During Netanyahu's term in office, Israeli-only roads were built as first step in constructing settlements in the controversial E1 zone. Now Bennett has revived the plan and the actual construction for E1. Palestinians warned this project would practically cut the occupied West Bank in half. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after he defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy, already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What could come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa. Amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 Army Reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, People in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
South Korea has been hit hard by a fourth wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, with new daily cases over 1,000 for the past week. More than 50% of the recent new cases have been the more contagious Delta variant. The government has issued a number of restrictions and guidelines, including banning gatherings of more than two people, other than family, after 6 p.m.
Please refrain from going out or holding social gatherings and abide by the disinfection guidelines wherever you are. Even if you don't have symptoms, please protect yourself and your loved ones by getting tested. We can and must overcome this crisis. The government will do its best.
Bae Hyung-won and his wife operate a small seafood restaurant in Incheon, just outside of Seoul. He diligently disinfects his restaurant, adhering to social distancing protocols and other government guidelines. He says a lot of businesses in the neighborhood are just hanging on.
The current situation is affecting us tremendously. Up to now, the first to third waves of the coronavirus weren't so bad. But as soon as the fourth wave started, from the first day, the number of customers plunged by 80 to 90%.
As many countries around the world are now opening up, South Korea is under more pressure from a restive public to respond more effectively to the outbreak. Young people have been especially critical, as they will wait months for their shots amid shortages of vaccine supplies. The South Korean government had set a goal of November to achieve herd immunity. Currently, about 12% of the population has been fully vaccinated, while health officials emphasize the importance of the next 2 months in containing the recent wave of infections. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the UK, number 10 has become the centre of a racism controversy which has sharply escalated following England's crushing defeat to Italy in the Euro 2020 football competition.
I just don't support, you know, people participating in, you know, that type of gesture politics to a certain extent as well.
Started after Home Secretary Priti Patel condemned England players for kneeling in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement in the early stages of the competition. And as fans booed the players' gesture, the Prime Minister, who has been accused of holding racist views himself, refused to condemn fans' behaviour. But now, following England's defeat and intense racist abuse black players have received from fans online, Johnson and Patel have tried to hop aboard the anti-racism bandwagon, a move critics condemn.
It's rather ironic that the government are making these statements today when the Running Me Trust has just published a report saying that they may be in breach of the UN Convention on Racial Discrimination due to systemic racism in this country. And it's got to be said that the government has facilitated that, I think, with the hostile environment. It's criticism of the Black Lives Matter, dismissing the group as run by Marxists. I think that they've really not covered themselves in glory at all.
Additional embarrassments for number 10 as the Football Association has rejected an invitation to an honorary event that was to be held for the England team outside Downing Street this week. And also high-profile football personalities have gone on record and publicly condemned the government for allegedly stoking the flames of racism in the UK. But can this fire ever actually be extinguished? That is the question that's proving very difficult to answer. Robert Carter, London.
On Wednesday in the Italian capital, humanitarian activists gathered outside the Italian parliament to stage a protest against an anti-migration deal between Rome and Tripoli. The protest, dubbed a blindfold to avoid seeing the truth, was called by a number of NGOs ahead of a crucial parliamentary vote on the renewal of the accord. protesters were saying the deal has been causing suffering to tens of thousands of refugees since its signing in 2017.
Under the deal, Italy helps Libyan maritime authorities to stop boats at sea and return the illegal migrants to detention centers in Libya. At least 50,000 people, including thousands of children, have been returned to the northern African country so far. However, the condition in Libya is a matter of concern as they face detention and serious abuse, including rape and torture.
I think it's not a problem, unfortunately, only of the Italian government and the country. It's a European problem, and the European policies, basically, Europe endorses the Italian initiative.
During the protest, activists read messages of desperation sent by the refugees trapped in war-ravaged Libya. Some refugees have unsuccessfully attempted to cross the Mediterranean up to 3-4 times.
Facciamo finta di non vedere cosa succede.
We keep turning a blind eye to what is happening in Libya. The decision to renew the deal is a shameful display of how far EU governments are prepared to go to keep refugees and migrants from Europe's shores.
C'è una parte della politica italiana.
Here in Italy, some politicians deal with the migrants as if they were enemies at the gates, creating fear among Italians. The other politicians make sure not to create too much discomfort to their electorate.
Some lawmakers who attended the protest also said that an Italian Navy ship docked in Tripoli has even directly coordinated the intercepting activities carried out on the refugee boats by the Libyan Coast Guard. Later on Wednesday, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio told the House that Italy will no more fund the Libyan Coast Guard to encourage a management of migrant flows that is more respectful of international norms by Tripoli. Max Civili, Rome.
Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as the main U.S. military headquarters in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. This is why experts have blamed the U.S. for wasting international aids to Afghanistan by building America's largest military base in the country.
The U.S. has built Bagram military base by wasting international aids that were earmarked for modernization of the Afghan National Army and the country's development. The air base is now vacated without U.S. achieving its goals.
As this army general says, the U.S. forces informed Afghans of their pullout earlier but set no exact time for their departure.
Early morning, once we received some rumors that U.S. Army left the Bagram, we increased our intelligence and our report. We got that, yes, they left the Bagram. And after that, we entered to the base and took the all towers and secure inside of the Bagram as well.
After talking to the ANA commander, we headed to former symbol of U.S. military power in Afghanistan, Bagram Air Base. A parking lot is located at one of the four entrances of the air base. The U.S. forces have left many of these vehicles behind. Afghan forces say U.S. forces have disabled the electronic systems of these military vehicles instead of disabling the war machine of Taliban.
Now, Afghan officials said they are going to fix such military vehicles to use them in fighting against terrorism across Afghanistan.
After crossing the entrance gate, we faced a real American town where U.S. forces have spent long nights and days despite failing to achieve their major stated goal that was uprooting terrorism here. Now Afghans are in charge of such mission.
Having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups.
It seems that the U.S. forces had access to high technology, emergency protection measures and welfare amenities in different parts of this airfield to reduce the level of harm, particularly the psychological harm that was coming from the Afghan war to U.S. forces. For instance, this gas station had been supplying fuel to hundreds of big generators across the air base. Afghan forces have collected these GEM tools from different GEMs located in Bagram, saying the U.S. forces had access to not only GEMs, but also to cinema and restaurants as well.
despite being equipped with a modern air defense system protecting Bagram Air Base during U.S. military presence here, emergency exit ways like this one served as a central part of the base. Meanwhile, there have been hundreds of hideouts like this one built by American troops to protect them against possible Taliban rocket attacks. Visiting residential buildings of the U.S. forces in Bagram is also a need. But the bitter fact is that the Afghan forces even do not have access to the codes of some doors of the residential buildings in Bagram. So they have no way but to use things to keep the doors open. The presence of meal packages, air conditioner systems, refrigerators, microwaves, internet access and TVs that have been left in residential areas by the US forces once again proves that how big difference was and is between a foreign military soldier and an Afghan soldier. There are also many warehouses like this food warehouse in Bagram. Bagram Hospital is the other destination for us. The modern hospital is dark now and we need to use either torch or our camera light to see what is inside. The flame of Washington's longest war in Afghanistan hospitalized thousands of US soldiers in rooms like this one. These beds, medicines, and medical equipment could save the lives of thousands of wounded US troops. But hundreds of them lost their lives here in Bagram Hospital and never returned back to the US due to severe injuries. And now, with rising insecurity in Afghanistan, only time will tell whether or not the Afghan government can make this strategic air base operational due to shortage of financial resources. Sayed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in Northern Parwan Province.
The Iranian government has expressed anger over the participation of Italian politician Franco Frattini to a hybrid virtual and face-to-face meeting hosted by terror organization MKO in Albania last weekend. MKO is seen by geopolitical experts as a dangerous sectarian group that was on the list of terrorist organizations of the EU and the US for several years. Despite that, a number of international figures, including former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, have given their full support for this group.
The truth is that the MKO has always been instrumental to the geopolitical strategies of Western countries. It's been designated as a terrorist organization for many years, and its delisting was very much linked to a plan to increase pressure on Tehran. This only shows the double standards of the West when it comes to terrorist groups. MKO's collusion with the US and the Israeli intelligence is a known fact.
Frattini is a former European Commissioner and Foreign Minister under two Berlusconi governments between 2002 and 2011. As the head of Italy's foreign affairs, in 2003 he sent an Italian military and police contingent to Iraq and Afghanistan in support of the US hegemonic influence in the Middle East. Frattini currently holds the post of director of the prestigious Italian Society for International Organization, a non-profit body operating under the supervision of the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Contacted by Press TV, the former Italian minister has declined to comment on its appearance at the MKO event held in Albania.
Frattini's participation in the MKO's annual conference comes as no surprise. Some governments interacting with terrorist organizations to avoid boots-on-the-ground combat operation need well-known political figures who support them to validate their illegal actions.
Iran has summoned the ambassador of Slovenia to Tehran to voice protest at the Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participation in the anti-Iran virtual gathering organized by the MKO. In an official letter of protest, Tehran has called the Slovenian Prime Minister's move unacceptable and undiplomatic.
Ties between Italy and Iran have been forever connoted by consistent mutual empathy, to the point that not even the US unilaterally imposed sanctions completely stop their relations. Rome has long been Tehran's main trade partner, and hundreds of Italian companies are looking forward to fully resuming trade with Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
a Yemeni rights advocacy group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development, has released a new report. It highlights the destruction of Yemen's infrastructure in over 6 years of war by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies.
The bombardments of civilian areas by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes and artillery units have turned more than 500,000 homes into ruin. The attacks have also targeted 15 airports across Yemen, turning them non-operational. The seaports in the impoverished country, which are the only lifeline for people, have not been spared either. 16 Yemeni ports have been damaged in the coalition airstrikes. The ongoing Saudi-led military campaign has also resulted in the total or partial destruction of 391 hospitals or health facilities.
An important part of the report also highlights the number of victims of the Saudi-led war. The advocacy group says more than 43,000 Yemenis have been either killed or injured in the conflict.
17,176 people have been killed in Saudi-led attacks on Yemen. These include more than 3,800 children and 2,400 women. 26,700 people have also been wounded. These include over 4,200 children and 2,800 women.
Children have sustained a significant number of casualties in Saudi-led attacks. Yet the United Nations last month, in a controversial move, added Yemen's Ansarullah movement to its 2021 list of violators of children's rights. That sparked condemnations with Yemen's political leadership, saying that such a move by the world body is detached from realities on the ground and is not based on independent reports. Last year, the UN removed the Saudi-led coalition from the List of Shame, an annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. That despite the UN's own investigators found the coalition of killing or injuring hundreds of children in its relentless bombing campaign on the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia was first included on the blacklist in 2016, but the decision was reversed shortly after the kingdom threatened to cut off funding to UN programs. The UN this year excluded Saudi Arabia from the list, not to antagonize the kingdom again. Riyadh, along with some of its allies and backed by the West, has been bombing Yemen since 2015. It has also imposed an all-out blockade on the country. These have resulted in the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where 2 in 3 people, according to the UN, need help to survive, and children are dying from entirely preventable causes in their thousands. According to Yemen's health ministry, at least one child dies every 5 minutes as a result of Saudi siege or attacks. The extent of casualties and damage reveals the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition toward Yemen. Still, the West and the UN continue to show their double standard when it comes to Yemen and embolden Saudi Arabia to continue committing crimes. It seems what matters the most is Saudi petrodollars, not the loss of innocent human lives.
In the limelight. Smoke and heat from a huge wildfire in southeastern Oregon are creating giant fire clouds over the blaze. Dangerous columns of smoke and ash that can reach up to 6 miles in the sky and are visible from more than 100 miles away. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled Oregon Wildfire Causes Miles-High Fire Clouds as Flames Grow. Stay with us for more of the article from The Guardian. Smoke and heat from a huge wildfire in southeastern Oregon are creating giant fire clouds over the blaze. Dangerous columns of smoke and ash that can reach up to 6 miles in the sky and are visible from more than 100 miles away. Authorities have put these clouds at the top of the list of the extreme fire behavior they're seeing amid the Bootleg Fire, the largest wildfire burning in western United States. The inferno grew on Friday to about 377 square miles, that is 976 square kilometers, an area larger than New York City, and was raging through a part of the American West that is enduring a historic drought. Meteorologists this week also spotted a bigger, more extreme form of fire cloud, ones that can create their own weather, including fire tornadoes. Extreme fire behavior, including the formation of more fire clouds, was expected to persist on Friday, 16th of July, and worsen into the weekend. There are currently at least 70 wildfires burning in the western United States, and dozens more are burning in Canada. Devastatingly high temperatures are also expected to bake western United States through the weekend, from the central Rockies into southern Canada, as the region braces for the fourth heat wave in 5 weeks. Forecasts estimate that highs across the region will be 20 to 30 degrees Fahrenheit higher than average for this time of the year. By Monday, 19th of July, Bozeman, Montana may see temperatures as high as 107 degrees Fahrenheit, that is 41.6 degrees Celsius, the hottest temperature the city has ever recorded. The heat will complicate firefighting efforts and increase the threat of new ignitions. Firefighters were scrambling on Friday, 16th of July, to control the raging Bootleg wildfire, which is spreading miles a day in windy conditions. Authorities have ordered a new round of evacuations amid worries that the inferno, which has already destroyed 21 homes, could merge with another wildfire that has also exploded in size. Pyrocumulus clouds, literally translated as fire clouds, look like giant dirty colored thunderheads that sit atop a vast column of smoke coming up from a wildfire. Often the top of the smoke column flattens out to take the shape of an anvil. In Oregon, fire authorities say the clouds are forming between 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. each day as the sun penetrates the smoke layer and heats the ground below, creating an updraft of hot air. Crews are seeing the biggest and most dangerous clouds over a section of wilderness made up mostly of dead trees, which burn instantly and with a lot of heat. For 4 days in a row, the Bootleg wildfire has generated multiple fire clouds that rise nearly 6 miles into the atmosphere and are easily visible from 100 to 120 miles away, authorities said on Friday. The conditions that create the clouds were expected to worsen over the weekend. When a pyrocumulus cloud forms over a fire, meteorologists begin to watch carefully for its big brother, the pyrocumulonimbus cloud. NASA has called the latter the fire-breathing dragon of clouds because it is so hot and big that it creates its own weather. In a worst-case scenario, fire crews on the ground could see one of the monster clouds spawn a fire tornado, generate its own dry lightning, and create dangerous hot winds below. The clouds can also send particulate matter from the smoke column up to 10 miles above the Earth's surface. So far, most of the clouds on the Bootleg wildfire have been less intense fire clouds, but the National Weather Service on Wednesday spotted a pyrocumulonimbus cloud forming in what it called terrifying satellite imagery. Please send positive thoughts and well wishes to the firefighters. It's a tough time for them right now, the Weather Service said in a tweet. Meanwhile, a wildfire near northern